Well, good morning. It's Super Bowl Sunday. Yeah, it's one of my favorite Sundays of the year. Also known as the weekend I become a fan of whatever team's playing against the Patriots. Yeah. Yeah. All right, you can clap for that. Yeah, I really do love Super Bowl Sunday. It's one of my favorites, but that's not what I'm here to talk to you about, of course. My name's Nick, in case we had a chance to meet. So nice to meet you. Again, it's always a pleasure to be up here with you. But this past week, I came across a photo series by a photographer named Tom Husey, and I think we have some images of this photo series, but they're pictures of elderly folks looking into a reflection and seeing a younger version of themselves looking back at them. So maybe you've seen this, I've seen it in several magazines. It really moved me. I started thinking about it. It's like we live in a culture that I don't feel like always treats the elderly with a whole lot of dignity. Right? It's like we have this obsession with youth. And so it seems like once you reach a certain age, you're kind of forgotten about, right? You're sort of marginalized, kind of pushed off to the sides. And I think what this photo series does is it confronts us with the fact that these people are people, right? They're not problems to be dealt with, people to be avoided, but they're actually people, people with histories, people with stories. Sometimes we forget that, right? We forget that elderly folks weren't always elderly. But there was a time when they were actually like your age and they were going through some of the similar things that you're going through right now, right? At the same time, I think it's a reminder for all of us in the room who maybe we're young right now. Guess what? You're not always going to be young. One day that'll be you looking in the reflection, wondering where's all the time gone? Somebody say amen to that. Yeah, and I think it confronts us with all of this. It captures all of that and it has this weird way of connecting us. Or maybe you've had a moment like this. Maybe you've had a moment with one of your parents where you suddenly woke up to the fact that there was a time when they were actually like your age and they were wrestling with some of the things that you're wrestling with right now. Like you kind of had this like light bulb moment. Like, wow, my parents weren't always just a lot older than me. They were actually people too, right? And they had a life and they've had experiences. And it's like when we realize that, when we connect with that, it has this way of endearing us to them. Because when you're younger, when you're younger like a teenager, you think your parents are clueless, right? They have no idea what's going on. They're so out of touch. They're like the last person you're ever gonna wanna ask advice from. But then as you get older, this kind of starts to change. And usually when you become a parent yourself and you realize how hard it is and you realize that you're actually the one who's clueless and it feels like your foot stuck in your mouth, you've been there before. You tend to offer a bit more compassion to your parents. You like let them off the hook a little bit. And what I've noticed for a lot of people is it's right about this season where a really cool friendship develops between a parent and their kid. And this happens for all sorts of reasons, but I would argue one of the biggest reasons why it happens is because you actually humanize your parents a little bit. They're people with a history, with a story, and it has this powerful way of connecting us to them. I think this is really sort of the heart of this entire series we've been doing, called Dear Church. We've been taking a look at some of the letters written by the Apostle Paul to the first churches. And our hope for this series is that it would connect you to like the realness of the Bible, to the humanness of the Bible. Because see, there are, of course, when it comes to the scripture, there's the words on the page, but then there's also like the words behind them, right? The words beyond them. Like there's the stories behind all of them. And when you realize, when you come to grips with the fact that the Bible was written by very real people to other very real people going through very real things, and when you come to understand why these words were so meaningful and so powerful for people who first heard them, it becomes really obvious why they're still so powerful for us today. So that's kind of been our goal throughout this series, is to kind of get you in touch with the story behind the scriptures. And this morning, we get to look at my favorite. I'm not sure if pastors are supposed to have favorites, but I do. So, favorite letter, probably favorite book in the entire Bible, the letter of Philippians. Come on, y'all give it up for Philippians. Come on now. Oh. This is as good as it gets. Now, there's no way we're going to be able to unpack everything Philippians has to say to us in one Sunday morning. I'm probably going to get you out a little late already. So there you go. But I do want to encourage you, if you've never been, come check out Midweek on a Wednesday night. We'll keep this conversation going. I'll be up there Wednesday in the chapel, 6:15. We're going to unpack a bit more of what Philippians has to say. But if you haven't been, I'd love for you to come and try it out with me. But in every single letter, Paul addresses numerous issues, but there seems to always be like one or two big ones. And so that's what I want us to look at this morning. I want us to get in touch with the heart of the letter to the Philippians. Are you with me? So one of the reasons why Paul is writing to the Philippian church is to kind of give them an update on how he's doing, to let them know about his circumstance. You see, Paul is writing from prison. Verse 7, he mentions his chains. He's in prison. Probably at this time, he's in Rome. And he's there because of his allegiance to Jesus and his refusal to acknowledge Jesus as Lord. So in many ways, he's been identified as an enemy of the state, almost like a terrorist, right? He's somebody who they have got their eye on. And you can tell from other places in the letter, Paul is beginning to see where this is eventually headed. If he keeps up, then he knows it's only a matter of time before he is eventually killed. And this letter, there are some places where you can tell he's beginning to kind of see that, feel that. And so the Philippians, they've heard about this. They've heard about Paul and the fact that he's in prison. And so they've sent somebody to check on him. But at the same time, they want to let Paul know that things back in Philippi are starting to heat up too. Let me just read you a passage from chapter 1. You kind of start to feel this and notice it. Chapter 1, verse 27. Paul says to this church, "Whatever happens, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Then, whether I come and see you or only hear about you in my absence, I will know that you stand firm in the one spirit, striving together as one for the faith of the gospel, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you." Who do you typically have to say, don't be afraid to? People who are feeling a little afraid, right? Those are the folks who kind of have to say, hey, don't be afraid. Obviously, they're afraid, right? They're wrestling with this a little bit. "This is a sign to them that they will be destroyed, but you will be saved, and that by God. For it has been granted to you on behalf of Christ, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for him. Since you were going through the same struggle you saw that I had, and now hear that I still have." So some things we can gather. There's so much going on there. That text is unreal too. But one of the details we can gather is that it seems the Philippians are starting to experience a bit of what Paul has already gone through. There's some persecution coming their way, right? It's starting to get heated up in Philippi. And you can imagine what they're thinking. I mean, here's our leader, right? Here's our leader. He's in prison, possibly going to be executed. They're starting to ask questions. What's that mean for us? What's going to happen back here? Is this where things are headed to? So one of the reasons why Paul is writing the Philippians is to encourage them, and it's to offer them some perspective. Because you see, peppered throughout this entire letter, what we hear from Paul is him urging the Philippians to hold on to joy. Ooh, y'all say that word with me, you ready? Joy. Oh, come on. You don't say joy like that. Joy doesn't just like fall out of your mouth. Joy. You don't say joy that way. How do you say joy? Joy. Say joy. Come on. Joy. Yes. This letter is all about joy. It's everywhere. I mean, all throughout this letter, Paul is urging them, whatever you do, I know, hold on to joy. The word shows up at least 13 times in 4 short chapters. Don't you just love the sound of that word though? Joy. It's like, what comes to mind when you think about joy? Like joy is that enduring sense of delight. It goes way beyond happiness, doesn't it? It's like happy is a nice word. It's a fine word. But next to joy, what's happy sound like? Like soggy. It's like, ugh. Like, why would you settle for happy when you could have joy? Are you with me? Joy goes beyond happiness, doesn't it? Joy is those moments in your life where you felt most alive. Right, when you think about those moments, you can't help but smile. You got some of those? That's what joy is. It's joy are those moments where we are so aware of what actually matters. And we feel connected to it, right? That's joy. It's that abiding, enduring sense of delight. It goes way beyond just being happy. Who doesn't want to know a thing or two about joy? And again, this is what Philippians is all about. From front to back, we find Paul urging them, whatever you do, I know it's hard, whatever you do, hold on to joy. I mean, in fact, chapter 4, verse 4, Paul says this, "Rejoice in the Lord sometimes." Just when you feel like it, whenever Tom Brady gets sacked. No. Rejoice in the Lord always. And that Greek word for always means always, always. I will say it again, rejoice. See, he puts an exclamation mark after the word. It means you can't say it like you're half asleep. Rejoice, and rejoice is the verb form of joy. It means hold on to the joy. Or if you literally break it down, here's what it means. It means never lose sight of the gift. See the gift, be aware of the gift. It has this root word grace, which means gift. Hold on to that. Whatever else, hold on to that. Right here from the beginning. Here we go. First insight we could take away from Philippians. You ready for this? Joy is not circumstantial. If you're taking notes, maybe write that down. Joy is not circumstantial. Reminder, where is Paul when he's writing this? Not Disney World. Not Turks and Caicos. Not a Cantina 76 with a plate full of tacos in front of him. I don't daydream about tacos. He's in prison. He has chains on. And yet the one thing he keeps coming back to is joy. Hold on to the joy. Now, I got to make this clear. Despite being a letter about joy, this is also probably Paul's letter. It's one of the reasons why I love it, where he gets the most candid with us. Like, he actually gives us some insight into how he's doing. There's this section in chapter 1. I just find it so fascinating. It's almost like Paul forgets that he's writing to other people, and it's almost like he's writing in his own journal. And he starts to get honest about how he's feeling. And he says at one point, he's like, you know what? I'm torn. A part of me would rather just die and go and be with Jesus. I'd be better by far right now. And now we have this tendency to like over-spiritualize this passage and make it about like Paul's belief in the afterlife. I'm not saying that isn't involved here, but I don't think that's not the climate of this passage. You don't use the words like torn, right? It's anguish here. I mean, Paul's worn out. Ever been there before? I mean, he's just tired. He's getting run over by everybody. He's been beaten up countless times. I mean, he's been rejected and betrayed by his own people. He's emotionally exhausted. He's fried. And so he says, you know what, big part of me, I'd just rather call it a day. I would much rather just quit. Throw in the towel, I'd rather die and go and be with Jesus. But he says, I will remain. I will continue with you. I'm going to keep going. What does this mean? Here's what this means. Maybe write this down too. Joy is not fake happy. Did you hear me? It's not fake happy. It's not when somebody's going through a really rough time. It's like, oh, just suck it up. God has a plan for everything. That's not what this is about. It's grittier than that. It's steelier than that. It's a little dirtier than that. But it certainly is not circumstantial. Joy is not circumstantial. You see, you and I, we have this tendency to buy into this lie that joy, that deep sense, that abiding sense of delight that taps into the meaning of everything, right? We have this tendency to believe that that's circumstantial, that it's this weird involuntary reaction to certain specific conditions about our life. So we tend to think. We tend to think that joy is for those people for whom everything is worked out for. They know joy, right? The people who just won the lottery, they know joy. People who got the house, who got the job, who got the kids, who never get in trouble, they're the ones who know joy. That's who joy is for. Joy is for the people whom, for everything, all the conditions in their life are just perfect, and they know joy. What's funny is, in so many faith traditions, even outside of Christianity, do you know who the people who know the most joy? People who have often been through the most suffering. I mean, who are we eager to learn about joy from? People who've been through it. And some of you out here, you've been through some difficult illnesses in your life. You didn't know if you were going to make it or not. You know the joy of a good meal. And believe me, I've interacted with a whole lot of people who have everything they've ever wanted. Guess what they don't have? Joy. It's not circumstantial. Or we tend to buy into this lie that what we need is somewhere else. Right? If I could just get that, if I could just go there, if I could just have them, then I would know joy. That's a lie too, though, isn't it? It's like, remember when you were in high school and you couldn't wait to graduate? It's like, I'm a graduate, I'm gonna go to college. When I go to college, it's gonna be, I'm gonna have all this freedom. Then you gotta go to school, write papers, and have a job. And then, like, after a while in college, you start thinking, man, I can't wait till I graduate from college. I'm gonna have freedom. Then you have to go to work all day and you can't take a nap anymore. And what do you start thinking? Oh, man, I just want to go back to college, right? We buy into it, it's a lie. Well, what we believe that what we're looking for somewhere else, sometime else, with somebody else, it's all a lie. Joy is not circumstantial. It's not. And when we buy into that lie, our life becomes so reactionary. Do you ever feel that way? It's like you're just reacting all the time. Things are good, I'm good. Things are bad, I'm bad. It's like wasps. You know wasps? Bzzz, and they sting you. Ah, wasps. It's my impression of wasps. Wasps, believe it or not, I'm about to drop some knowledge on you. Wasps are very sensitive to light. They're attracted to light. And at nighttime, they start acting really funny, real weird. And so when I was a kid, we would mess with them. This is what you do in Indiana growing up. You play basketball and you mess with wasps, okay? But if there's some wasps around and you turn on the porch light at night, all the wasps will like fly up to it. They're just there and they're all around it. But then when you turn the light off, it like freaks them out. They get all disoriented, and they literally, I'm not kidding you, they drop straight to the ground. You can hear them. They go, duh, 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 duh. Right? And then when you turn the light back on, they'll kind of like fly up, like staggering all, and they'll like fly back up to the light. You just keep doing it over and over. It's great. I thought I was making this up. You know, I was like, is this one of those stories? I mean, is this really happening? Am I making this up? Pastors do that sometimes. So I Googled it, sophisticated form of research. And sure enough, there's a video of a guy doing this. It's like from Indiana or something. And I was like, pastime, messing with wasps. But here's the truth. That's a picture of how so many of us live. The lights are on. Things are good. I'm good. This is awesome. Don't you just love life? And the minute we come into any type of struggle, difficulty, the lights go out, what do? We hit the deck. We freak out. We fall apart. That's exhausting, isn't it? It's up and down. This good, this bad. You see, Paul doesn't live that way. Paul's more steady. Now understand, for Paul, the light's off right now. Things don't look good. In fact, they look pretty bad for him. Yet he's still holding on to joy. So here's the thing, and if you're taking notes, maybe you write this down. Joy is not a matter of circumstance. Joy is a matter of conviction. Joy is not a matter of circumstance. Joy is a matter of conviction. You see, all throughout this letter, one of the things we hear from Paul over and over again, he shares with us these deep convictions, like these beliefs that have gotten into his bones, these beliefs that have gone to his core about who God is and how God works in the world. I mean, like right from the beginning, chapter 1, this may be my favorite passage in the entire letter. Chapter 1, verse 3, Paul's speaking to the Philippians. He says, I thank my God every time I remember you. In all my prayers for all of you, I always pray with joy. There's our word, joy, because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now. Being confident of this, that's conviction language. Being confident of this, ooh, and here's where it goes. This is so good. That he who began a good work in you will see it through to completion until the day of Christ Jesus. That he who began a good work in you, the God who started something in you, is going to see it through. He's going to stay at work in you. Now, this is powerful enough on a surface level reading, right? To hear those words. Let's unpack it a bit. It'll blow your mind. See, Paul is actually referencing the creation story, the creation poem from Genesis chapter 1. Paul knew his scriptures so well, he couldn't help but weave them in and out of his own writings. And so often what you find in his letters, he sort of winks and nods back to the Old Testament. And here he's doing that with the creation story. I mean, think back there with me. Genesis chapter 1, you have God sort of doing some of these unbelievable works. And after each one of them, there's this refrain that shows up over and over again. What is it? God saw that it was good. And this continues until day 7. Day 7, we find God resting because his initial work of creation had been brought to what? Completion. Bring all this back to Philippians. What Paul is saying to these people who are starting to experience some of what he's experiencing is this. Listen, when you entrusted yourself to the saving love of God, when you said yes to Jesus, the same nuclear life-giving power that brought all of this into existence is the same power that exploded inside of you. God is working in you. That power is unleashed in you. Turn to your neighbor and say, you're a piece of work. But I mean, just get honest with me for a second. How much of our life would change if we just would tap into that from time to time? I mean, if we would just stop ourselves and go, you know what? I don't have to do this. You know why? The same power that God used to sort of bring all this into existence and however way he did that, same power that's keeping it all going, that power is at work in me and I got access to it. I don't have to do this. Could you imagine? Unbelievable declaration. Conviction about who God is and how God works in the world. This is declaration of God's faithfulness. It's not a matter of if God's going to show up. It's a matter of when and how God is going to show up. I mean, is God going to see this through? Let me ask you a question. Did the sun rise this morning? Do you believe it's going to rise tomorrow? You bet your life on it. God is going to show up. God is going to be faithful. God is going to see this through. I'm wondering if there's anybody in the room that needs to believe that this morning. Not just hear it, but trust it. Because you see, for Paul, this isn't just some warm, fuzzy sentiment for him. He's in prison, folks. He's a dead man walking. This isn't some warm, fuzzy feeling for him. This is a conviction. This isn't like a Christian t-shirt conviction either. You sort of take on and off whenever you feel like it. And Paul isn't saying this one day knowing that people are just going to slap it on coffee mugs and bumper stickers. This is a conviction that has gotten into his bones. It's gone to his core. He's allowed God to convince him at his deepest parts that he's good, that he's faithful. It's interesting, isn't it, that it's usually not until the lights go out when you find out what you really believe. Are you with me? You want to know what somebody really believes? Watch them in difficulty. Watch them when the pressure's on. Watch them when it's hard. Or watch them when it's really easy to do the wrong thing. What do they do then? You want to find out what they really believe? It's usually not until the lights go out. Until we feel like we're going to hit the deck. But see, for Paul, this conviction about the faithfulness of God has become a lens through which he sees everything. And his joy comes from this deep belief that God's up to something, that God is faithful. I mean, even look later in chapter 1, verse 12. Paul says, "Now I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has actually served to advance the gospel." What? He's in prison again. He's been beaten up. God's using this to advance the gospel. As a result, it has become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I am in chains for Christ. And because of my chains, most of the brothers and sisters have become confident in the Lord and dare all the more to proclaim the gospel without fear. How would you like to be Paul's, like, prison guard? Hey, man, what you doing? Can I tell you a story? Whatever's going on. I mean, Paul's like, honest, this is not good. This is really hard. But I want you to know, God's still using it. It's this unbelievable conviction that God doesn't waste anything. And whatever it is, God's going to use it. It's this deep conviction for Paul. Now, what I've noticed about you and I is that we are okay with doing this in retrospect. Like, as we look back, we're good at noticing God's faithfulness and God's goodness when we look back, right? It's a bit easier for us. Like think about the stories that you love to tell around the dinner table or the stories you like to hear from other people. They probably weren't the most fun stories to live through. Are you with me? And often your favorite parts of the story, your favorite memories of the story, like the ones you just love to tell and you get like, you make sure you get all the details right, they probably were like the worst parts of the story when you're living through it. Even in funny ways, right? Like that camping trip you went on where you had everything planned, it was gonna be awesome, and then you get there and it pours down rain and it's a snowstorm in June and nobody had any clothes or whatever it was. And like, you know, at the moment you're like, you're hating every bit of it. But when you tell the story like a year later, you love those parts. You with me? Or when I get to talk to influential people who have had success in their fields. For me, I love talking with influential leaders in the church, and you're asking them about, you know, how did all this happen? Like, talk to me about this. And they're like, you know, the success looks great, but let me tell you how it started. Because when we first got started, we thought we were crazy. Those are the stories they love to tell you. So what we're doing is we're looking back on these difficult moments, and you know what? We're reframing it. We're reframing it around the goodness of God, the faithfulness of God. And often we do this for each other too. It's like a while back, my son had his first run-in with like a bully getting picked on. And it was hard for him because it was somebody that he thought he was like close to. And so he was having a hard time like wrapping his head around this, like why this was happening. And so I started telling him about, you know, times when I went through getting bullied, getting picked on. He was like, Dad, you got picked on? And I had to explain to him, you know, that there was a long season of my life where I looked like a meatball with feet. And, you know, I haven't grown out of that one yet. But it was like, you know, on the one hand, we're laughing about these things and we're connecting around it. But you know what else it did? I think it showed him, hey, me too. And guess what? I'm still here. I'm still here. I made it. You can too. It's this reframing. Those were painful moments for me when I was a kid. And I'm not gonna lie, it's not that they aren't painful anymore, but when you reframe it through the faithfulness of God, through this goodness of God, it's not that they aren't painful, they just didn't win. Are you with me? You see, what we do with our past, Paul has learned to do it in the present. Paul isn't just looking back on past trials and reframing them through the goodness of God. He's doing it in the midst of them. Can you imagine? See, joy is not circumstantial. Joy is a matter of conviction. Here's where maybe you begin to see what it really is. Joy is not fake happy. It's not flaky. It's not pretend happy. Joy is this steely, unwavering determination to believe that God is up to something even in the midst of this. That's joy. Are you with me? I really hope you'll come back on Wednesday night because there's so much more I want to say. And there's a lot we can unpack from Philippians about how to practically live this out and even some of the ways in which we get tripped up with it. But I want to share just a couple thoughts with you before you go about where all this begins. First thing I want to say is that this kind of joy isn't forced. This kind of joy is given to us. This kind of joy comes from surrendering yourself to the saving love of God. This isn't something you can conjure up or manufacture. This is something that comes. This is something you sort of fall into. This is something you are overwhelmed by. This is something God does supernaturally at the core of who you are. It's when we allow ourselves to be invaded by the goodness of God. This kind of joy doesn't come from reading the right books or getting the right advice. Don't get me wrong, that stuff nurtures it. It really does, but it doesn't start there. Not the kind of joy that endures through this kind of stuff. I remember a few weeks ago when we started this series, I shared with you about one of my heroes, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, right? And a letter that he wrote from a Nazi prison camp to his fiance. Well, I came across another letter. Whew, this one got me. It taps into this. In case you weren't here, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a renowned German theologian and pastor who would not pledge his allegiance to Hitler and the Nazi regime. And as a result, he and his friends, they were thrown into prison. Eventually, Bonhoeffer was even executed just weeks before his prison camp was liberated. But in this letter, he's writing from prison and he's writing to some friends who are trying to pastor a church in Germany in the midst of all this, right? Listen to what he says. It says, how can we help those who have become joyless and without courage? You ever find yourself there? Without joy, without courage. If we not ourselves are bearers of courage and joy. Here's where, what is meant is not something artificially worked up or demanded of us, but it's a gift freely given. Joy dwells in God and comes from him, possessing spirit, soul, and body. And once this joy has grasped a person, make some noise if you know a thing or two about this. Once this joy has grasped a person, it grows. It carries him away. It throws open the closed doors. The joy of God has been through the poverty of the manger and the affliction of the cross. Therefore, it is indestructible, irrefutable. It does not deny affliction when it is there, but it finds in the very midst of distress that God is there. It looks death in the face, and it's just there that it finds life. It is of this joy we speak, a joy which is overcome. It alone is credible. It alone helps and heals. Listen to me. You can't force this. You can't sit alone in a room and say, I'm joyful, I'm joyful, and just be joyful. It's not going to work that way. This requires you to invite God to disrupt you at the core of who you are. To allow your inner self to be saturated, soaked, and overwhelmed by how good God is. It's a gift freely given. Maybe you're here today and you've never like received that gift. I don't care how many times you sat in this seat. That cloud, that darkness is still there. And I'm not saying there aren't gonna be work to be done after this. I'm telling you, this is where it starts. Maybe you're here and you let go of it a long time ago. In a little bit, we're going to be receiving communion. And the band's going to lead us through one last time of worship. You know why we do that, by the way. Not to just make you stay here any longer. But it's to give you time and space to actually respond to this. To react to it. Take advantage of that. Maybe in that time, in that space, just ask God to give you that gift freely given. To give you that joy. One more thought, I promise. You ready for this? Don't start playing yet. I'm not ready for you. Because that would just be really awkward. You'd probably be playing for a while. This thing that Paul's talking about, it's not divorced from his real life, his experienced life. We've talked about that a bit before. But this is flowing out of something that's actually just happened. You see, the clearest, most practical reason why Paul is writing this letter to the Philippians is to say thank you. It's to thank them for a gift of money. They've sent him money. See, he's in a Roman prison. In a Roman prison, they didn't feed you. They didn't give you water. They didn't give you anything. If you died, you died. They'd throw your body out and replace you with somebody else. You were entirely dependent on somebody outside to provide for you what you needed. And so when these Philippians heard about Paul's circumstance, they gathered some resources together and they sent somebody to him with it. Now keep in mind, this is not an easy journey. We're talking about several hundred miles. They walked by foot. Dangerous. At the same time, remember, Paul's an enemy of the state. It's not exactly safe to be associated with him. They risked all of that. And they showed up for their dear friend in his time of need. Now, we got to feel this, folks. You can't just read over this. You got to feel it. You got to feel this. How do you think Paul was feeling before that happened? I mean, you have to wonder, was he beginning to question, what are these other churches going to do when they realize I'm in prison being persecuted? Are they going to quit too? Are they going to bail? Are they going to throw in the towel? Then you even have to wonder, I mean, was he feeling forgotten? Like, is anybody going to show up? Does anybody know? Does anybody care about where I'm at right now? I mean, you can hear that in other places in the letter. Paul even says to the Philippians, you know what? You're the only ones that showed up. I'm telling you, this gift moved Paul. I mean, you can hear it in this letter. Listen to these words again. I thank my God every time I remember you. In all my prayers for all of you, I always pray with joy because of your partnership. This word is referring to a financial partnership. Your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now. You haven't quit. You haven't quit on me. You haven't bailed on Jesus. Being confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will see it through to completion. You know, I think Paul is saying those words to encourage them, but I kind of believe he's also saying it to himself. They've just proven it to be true. That God doesn't quit on us. That God doesn't forget about us. That God shows up. I hope you hear me when I say this. God's faithfulness is experienced through the faithfulness of God's people. When God shows up in your life, almost always, guess how he's going to do it? He's going to show up through somebody else. He is. And that's why here at this church, we are so committed to moving you into intentional communities, what we call small groups. These are quite simply people who show up for each other. And I've seen over and over again, I've seen God's faithfulness demonstrated through these groups. I've seen marriages resurrected. I've seen people there for other people to help pick up the pieces after the bottom's dropped out for something. I've watched people over and over again call out the greatness in each other. I've seen it. I've seen God show up and be faithful to the people in these groups. And so I've learned something. I've learned that whenever I find myself beginning to ask that question, where are you, God? You ever asked that? Where are you? I've learned that there's a better question to ask. It's, where am I? Particularly in relationship to other followers of Jesus. Because when God shows up, he's gonna show up through somebody else. We cut ourselves off from community. We cut ourselves off from the primary way in which God's gonna work in our lives. So if you don't have in a small group, I know a lot of you aren't. We actually have numbers and statistics on this. I know a lot of you aren't in small groups yet. There. Why not? Why not? I mean, here's what I want you to do. I want you to email me. Email the team, adultministry@mounthorribumc.com. That's all you got to do. Just start there. We'll follow up. But I promise you, if you want to see God show up in your life, you got to show up for some other people. You got to be plugged in. You got to have a tribe. Can I get an amen to that?